Nail and Reel 4. Let's talk a little bit more about your actual the actual team that operated this equipment. First of all, was this the same equipment that you had been using at Worcester and Malvern? And what did it consist of?
Yes. We got to our lot, went to Arras. We were taken into chalk dugout, chalk under audio.
Okay.
Those of us on this particular Arras sector were told to go into a particular point, which we found was an underground dugout of chalk. There we were, for the first time really, we were told what our duties were. The drill with the barrages was explained to us, and then our equipment was allocated. And as it happened, Nayland and Sellers were the first names that the officer called out to go with the first wave of infantry. We went to our starting point, and there we assembled our gear.
Okay, what did the gear consist
Now
of?
then, we had this BF set number one. This was about the size of a table sewing machine, but very much heavier. It had a leather strap over the top for carrying. It was made of teak, ebonite, and brass. It weighed a ton. Incidentally, when we captured a German similar set, it was made of aluminium and was very much lighter. We to drive to get the signals going, we had to have a big accumulator, and it was big, heavy, and very awkward to carry. So that was two things that were terribly awkward to carry. There was a roll of a brass mat, or it might have been copper, that was an earth mat. And that, as I remember it, was about 30 yards long. It might have been less, but it probably was about 30 yards long. Then we had two sets of tubular masts. They were 18 feet masts, six lengths of 3 feet. And aerial wire, I think that ran to about 60 yards, but where we were going to put 60 yards of aerial wire in the trenches, I don't know. Then we had stanchions. We had loads and loads of dry cells for operating the receiver. Then we had ropes, mallet, of course, and pegs. I think that was all about that. That was the entire wireless equipment, but our own personal equipment was terrible because we were in what was called battle order, which meant that we had our overcoats on, our British warms. We had a blanket rolled and twisted over our shoulder. We wore bandoliers with 60 rounds. We had a rifle on our back. We had a gas mask on the front. We had iron rations in a pocket in the tunic. And we had a first aid kit in our pocket. So one way and another, it was terribly difficult to move with all the stuff, particularly when the officer assembled us and said, "Now, right, Nayland and Sellers, you're the operators, you'll take this and that." We had four infantry men, and they were all clobbered up with the similar battle order, and they found it difficult to get a roll of wire or whatever it was under their arms. And then the officer's batman, he was carrying stuff for the officer. The officer himself, he had a map, and we had to sort of keep somewhere near him because he knew where we were destined to go. You see, he knew where the barrage was going to drop and at which point we were going to dig in.
Yeah. Now, as you were advancing as a little team, how would all of this gear be allocated for porterage?
As a matter of fact, we started off as well as we could to giving an even share, but during the trip across no man's land, into shell holes and out of them, down into trenches and up the other side, these infantry chaps, they were quite boys, they were only 18 years of age, and some of them were crying, and they had to be relieved of their load, you see, and it was hard going, because in addition to carrying these loads through mud-filled shell holes and taking cover, such as it was, whenever we could, because there was shrapnel falling above our heads all the time. But so that although we started off with the best of goodwill in the world, by the time we finished, some of us were carrying more than our allotted weight of stuff, while others could hardly carry themselves across. Well, it was very difficult keeping in touch with the officer, because, of course, he could whip along like a greyhound. He did carry an accumulator for a little while, but, as I say, we were able to keep an eye on him. Then Sellers and I think, were the key bods in keeping in touch, and then these infantry helpers tried to keep an eye on us. And eventually, about midday, we got to the designated dugout.
Now, when you went across to the Arras sector, this was your first experience of trench warfare. Were the trenches different in any way from what you expected? What were they like in this sector? Which was
no,
where?
They were. If they differed from my expectation, it was that the mud in them was more liquid. And if I may interject, I had had a new pair of breeches dished out to me just before we went to Arras. And when the sergeant, standing in the mud, called to me to jump in and to follow him, I said to him, "But I can't, sergeant, because I've got a new pair of breeches on." But the mud, it was liquid mud. And when I went in at Roclincourt, a place called Roclincourt in France. That was our centre. And that was the dugout that we set out from when the attack took place. And for days and days, we were in this mud, not quite as bad as the initial bath, but quite bad. And we didn't take our shoes and stockings off for several days and nights.
Your own uniform sounds rather more like a cavalryman's uniform than an infantry soldier.
Well, of course, the Royal Engineers is a mounted corps, and we wore a rider's uniform with breeches and spurs. Well, many of us had never seen a horse in motion, and certainly not ridden one, and we resented wearing these spurs and cleaning them, and we resented them even more when some of our chaps were called by outside officers to feed their horse or look after a horse. So one night when we in the Roclincourt district, we decided, as we were marching from one place to another, the 20 of us, we decided to throw our spurs away. We all agreed, and we got to a suitable spot, the ruins of a farmhouse, and we threw our spurs into the garden. And that was a big help to us, not to have to wear spurs in the mud of the trenches.
Now, this action at Arras, which was the first one you had been involved in, were there Did you personally feel any apprehension, or was apprehension common amongst the men at that point when you were building up to going over the top? What did it feel like? What were the kind of sort of mental problems and factors?
I don't think we thought about the danger of it at all. There was no question of being brave or cowardly. We had a job to do and we got on with it, and we hoped that if any disaster occurred, it would be to the other chap. I think that must have been at the back of our minds all through. It can't happen to me.
It's interesting, because at this stage of the war, in the autumn of 1916, of course, there had been a great deal of experience of tremendous casualties amongst the forces, and one would think, or at least someone of my generation would think, that those facts of what had gone before would cause a good deal of apprehension about, you know, what's going to happen to me.
Ah, that is quite right. But with us, you see, we were putting on the advance. We were part of an advance which was going to end the war. So the newspapers in Britain had said during that the winter before, this was it. This was the march into Germany. We were in a winning army. And at the start of that Easter Monday, it just felt like that, uncomfortable though it was. So personally, I think I can speak for the others too. We never thought, well, to hell with this. It won't happen to me, you see. Mm.
Well, the Arras operation was, I think, part of the... No, it wasn't, sorry, forget that. So in April 1917...
Easter Monday.
Easter Monday, the Battle of Arras was about to begin. Had you been told what your objective was?
We had been told that our objective was a broken-down farmhouse with a broken tree standing near it, right on the Hindenburg Line. The Hindenburg Line was a line of German dugouts. Mm. Double-deckers they were, which we didn't know on our side of the front. And when the barrage started in the morning, it was a terrific barrage over, I don't know, probably 14 miles of front. And it started with a terrific staccato precision. And once it started, our officer said, away we go. We humped our loads out of our dugouts and along one or two supporting trenches in which we had to step over the bodies of dead soldiers because who had been caught by shells that had come over in response to the barrage. Well, that was a bit shattering, but then when we got up onto the top over the front line, incidentally, we claim we were the first wireless operators ever to go over the top with the infantry, and subsequently I have queried that, and I still believe it to be true.
Yeah, so well, you got up.
We got up. We saw that the eight of us were more or less together, and away we went. Well, the first thing that happened to us, because it was not day, it wasn't quite daylight, day was breaking, and was the Germans suddenly started with this shrapnel. I forget what kind of shrapnel it was, but anyway, it was breaking just above our heads. And it was a damn nuisance, of course, because you could hear the bits splashing into the mud. And when it seemed to come rather near, we would throw ourselves down. But that wasn't a pleasant thing to do because the shell holes were filled with mud, as I said, and the ground was irregular everywhere. And we met with no resistance, except we did come across a German with a machine gun, and he was certainly having a go at the infantry people, but one of our Scotty boys got behind him and put an end to his capers. And
you went to the farmhouse, presumably.
Yes, but before we got there, we did get separated for a little while, and I found myself in a trench, a bit of a trench, and I turned a corner, turned a bend in it, and there I came across a German soldier. He was a man, I would think, about 40, which seemed very old to me at that time. And when he saw me, he shivered and put up his hands and, "Kamerad, Kamerad." Well, we had heard already that Germans were surrendering in thousands. You see, that was halfway through the morning. So we really were on our toes, thinking that we were this time going on to Germany. Well, this poor fellow, as I say, he got into a hell of a state. But I saw a sergeant of an infantry lot coming, and I shouted to him, "Can you take this chap away?" So he took him. Well, then, about midday, the shrapnel eased a bit in our particular area because it was dropping further back. And we got to this double-decker, luxury dugout. It was marvellous. It was lined with planks and supports inside. Then there was a stairs going down to another similar one down below. Well, this was absolute luxury, and the bottom one was being as safe as the Bank of England. So then the officer told these infantrymen to look around for booby traps while Sellers and myself tried to get the wireless set going. Fortunately, we were able to put up our 18-feet masts up on top of the Hindenburg line and ran a long, long aerial, and we were in business about 1 o'clock, as I remember it. But then, unfortunately, my pal Sellers developed telegraphist cramp in his operating